A couple of weeks ago, I was on my way to Kansas City to speak, and when I got to the Boston airport, my first flight was canceled because of mechanical problems, and I barely made the next flight, and it was delayed because of fog. And when I got to Chicago, there was one last connection and a mass of people in the waiting room, and I just didn't think I was going to get on that plane, and I just stood there and prayed. There was one seat left, and I got it. I was so thrilled, I kind of smiled at all the people in the waiting room, marched into the plane, sat down, it was a window seat next to a gentleman, and I really had had such a bad morning and was so tired and sort of discouraged from all my flights that I pulled out my Bible and I started reading in Acts because it's one of my very favorite books. I must have read about 20 minutes when the gentleman next to me tapped me. He said, "I really like that book." "The Bible?" "Yes," he said, "it's my favorite book." "Oh, you must be a real born-again Christian too." "No, I'm not, but I like the Bible." "Really?" "Yes," he said, "I grew up in Appalachia, and we were very poor. And missionaries came to us, and they taught me to read as a little boy from the Bible. It was the only book I had, and I read it over and over because I love to read, and it was all I had. So I've read the Bible through many times, and even now, it's my very favorite book to pick up and read." "Sir, how can you read the Bible through many times and not really fall in love with Jesus Christ?" "Well," he said, "I just hate these organized churches, all this organized religion. I resent it. They tell you you can't have a drink before dinner and you can't do this and that." And he said, I just resent the legal aspects of the church." "Sir, what is your name?" "Michael." "Michael, my name is Ann. And you know what Jesus says? Jesus says you will love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself. He says if you keep those two commandments, you've kept the whole law." "Sir, I'm not about to make any judgments on you in your life. It's just that simple. That's what the Word says." "Well, yes," he hadn't really thought about that. That sounded pretty freeing. "I have an idea." He said, "What?" "I could sing you a song, and I bet you'd like it." He said, "What did you say?" "Well, there's a song I know, and I love it, and I bet you'd like it too." Well, he looked very nervous. I started in, "Something beautiful, something good. All my confusion, sir." "You feel confused about Jesus and life?" "I know. So have I." "He understood. All I had to offer him was brokenness and strife. But he's making something beautiful out of my life." "Sir, that's what Jesus does. He changes everything. He's now a union worker. He goes and makes speeches all over the world for the union. His office is in Washington, D.C. He pulled out a little card. He said, "Would you tell me the names of some of your books? I'm going to go read them." Just as the plane was starting to send into Kansas City, I looked at him and said, "Michael, I bet you won't believe this, but I know God set me next to you on the plane." I said, "You wouldn't believe what a terrible morning I had. I mean, my first flight was canceled. My second one was an hour delayed. There was a whole group of people in the waiting room, and I got this seat. It was the last seat on the flight. And I know Jesus put me here." He just looked at me. "He did. He wanted me to tell you he loves you. He cares. He knows all the things deep inside of you that nobody else in the world knows but you and God. And he just wanted me to remind you that his love will follow you through all the rough places." "Michael," I reached out, he took my hand, I grabbed his. "I'm your friend too. Have a good day." And the plane landed in Kansas City and I deboarded. And I was just one ordinary young woman in the world. But again, I felt God had moved through my simple life. And I had moved the world in one small way because I reminded that man, Jesus Christ is love, and he can change anything. When I got to Kansas City, because there was such a mix-up in flights, I had to take a cab to the hotel. No one was there to meet me, and I got into the back seat of this Kansas City cab. And while we were driving toward the hotel, I just said to the driver, "Sir, what's the most exciting thing in your life?" "Happiness." "Happiness? That's great, sir. How do you find happiness?" "Well, lady, that's the problem. I haven't been happy for a long, long time." He said, "I married this one lady, and she has my baby, and I really love her the most, but she doesn't love me anymore, so now I'm getting ready to marry another woman. She's my second choice, but what can a man do in the world? People are always disappointing you." "I know, sir. A lot of people disappoint me, too. And you know the worst thing, sir? I disappoint myself. I do what I don't want to do. And even though I get discouraged when others disappoint me, I'm most discouraged when I do. That's why I believe in Jesus Christ, sir. I don't know if you're a religious man, but Jesus, I've known him for a long time. The Bible says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. And it's true, sir. He's never failed me. He's never even disappointed me. I sang him little songs. When we got to the hotel, I paid him an extra fat tip. When I crawled out of the back seat, I shook his hand. "Sir, you're one man and I'm one woman, but Jesus is our hope. And I pray for you bright shining tomorrows. I'll shout it from the mountaintop. I want the world to know the Lord of love has come to me. I want to pass it on." "Sir, can I take your hand?" "Or yours, ma'am?" "Little girl, can I play dolls with you? Can I love you in his name? Because on the bottom line of life, that's all there really is. You and Jesus and I and love where we live." When I was a little girl, I grew up in a parsonage. And all of my life I have built around two simple words. They're in my kitchen. They hang in my office. I wear the two words around my neck. "Yes, Lord. Yes to anything you ask of me, anytime, anywhere." But as a little girl, my dad would say to me, "It pays to serve Jesus." And I'd say, "Why, Daddy? I'm 9 years old and ugly, and hardly anybody likes me. Why does it pay?" And my dad said, "Give God time." I can remember when I was 13 saying, "Daddy, I've given him a few more years, and now I'm 13 and I'm still ugly, and I hardly have any friends." And my father said, "Honey, sometimes it takes the Lord years to make us something in life." And I would keep remembering that, but as a little child in Hawaii, everybody had beautiful dark skin and I was fair, and everyone was petite and I felt like a giant, and everybody was Buddhist or Hindu and I was a Christian. No one even heard of Christians, and my dad was a preacher besides. And I always felt like an oddball, and I always felt shy and insecure and worth zero. Outside my family, I felt like a zero. Then we went, Jan and I, my brother, we went to school, and I can remember when Jan and I were seniors in high school. At our high school, they gave a special award to a group of girls. The boys chose so many girls to be the queens, and it was sort of a queen system, and you reigned all year. And when they called us in and said Jan and I had been selected, well, we couldn't imagine. In all of our years, we had never been honored or recognized in any way. Well, they called us in to give us the announcement and said, "You know, there's only one request to be two queens on the campus for the year. You are to attend all of the big proms." Well, probably most of you don't understand, but you see, we were raised in a Nazarene home, and in the Nazarene faith, we were taught that it wasn't good to dance. I mean, that was against being a Christian. And if you dance out there today, I want to tell you, I think you can still be a Christian and do that. But I wouldn't know how to dance today because no one ever taught me, and when they said that, that did it. We said, well, we can't go to the proms. I mean, we don't go to proms. We don't even know how to dance. And we walked out tired and discouraged, and the principal called us in the next day and said, what if we ask permission from your father? If your father says it's all right, would you be able to do it? Jan and I said no, because we respect my dad. And if he said it was all right, he would do that just to give us freedom. But we love my dad, and we can't. Our first moment to be stars, and we couldn't accept it. And again, at 17, I said, Daddy, I've tried to follow Jesus all these years through all kinds of opposition. And why does it pay? Nothing good comes your way. And my dad would keep saying, if you trust Jesus, your life will turn out wonderfully. And I can remember the next morning when they all the boys congregated and they called us in and said, we've never done this before, but we respect you. And we've made a decision that you two can be the queens on this campus, and we'll send other girls in your place to all the proms. We felt like heroes. Our backs were straight. We could feel the sunrise in our lives. And for the first time in my whole life, I could say inside, Jesus, my dad was right. You make a difference. And I can remember when we graduated from high school, there were many students on the platform to receive awards. We were only receiving little honor awards for our grades. But there were some students receiving, you know, queen awards of special emphasis or getting scholarships to Harvard University. And suddenly the principal called Jan and me to the front. He said, us, we're Buddhist and Hindu, but these two girls, they're Christians. They have brought their God to our campus, and we will never forget. And while Harvard University students got many ovations, no one got the ovation that Jan and I did. And neither of us could speak. And I remember again standing there with my eyes swimming with tears. I was a little, homely, insecure 17-year-old girl. But in my heart I said, Daddy, you were right all along. Jesus changes everything. And yes, Lord, more and more began to be the theme and hope of my life. And we went to college, and Jan and I could have gotten scholarships for our grades at maybe bigger universities and not had to work so hard, but it was in my dad and mom's hearts that we go to a Christian liberal arts college, because we'd gone to school all our lives with Buddhists and Hindus, and they wanted us to have Christian exposure. Well, to go to this Christian school meant we had to work our way through. We started in at the dining room. But Jan, her job was to get up at 5:30 every morning, go to the cafeteria, to the dining room, and she had to set up the juice trays for everybody. But you see, Jan kept breaking glasses. So the man in charge of the cafeteria called her in and said, if you break one more juice glass, I'll fire you. And she came back to the dorm, and I said, honey, we can't let this happen. Why, if you lose this job, you won't be able to keep going to school, because we had loans and scholarships and our job. I said, I know. You see, I was always the leader, and she believed anything I said. Honey, I know. I'll take your job. They won't know the difference. You'll take my noon lunch line, and I'll take the juice job. Well, she thought that sounded like a pretty good idea, and I was confident. If Jan broke the glasses, I wouldn't. I marched out to the dining room early the next morning and filled my first tray with 30 glasses, poured all the juice, felt very confident. We had resolved it. Jan wouldn't get fired. We were going to make it through college. And I walked out with my first juice tray and didn't see a big carton of tables, flew over the carton of tables, and broke all 30 glasses. And all I could say when the dining room superintendent came up was, I'm not Jan, you can't fire me. Even to this day, when he sees me, if I go back to campus, he shakes his head and says, in all the years, I never had two like you Kimmel twins. But it was hard being in college. I mean, I had hard days. There were days when everybody else had dates and I didn't. It took a lot of work to walk through the snow and to work our way through college. And there was a lot of discouragement, and good and bad. I can remember when I was a junior in college, I received a call to Cornell University. They'd never offered this job to someone my age or to a girl. And again came back my thought, yes, Lord. Yes, Lord, to whatever you ask of me, anytime, anywhere. And I said to the people at Cornell, I'll have to pray about it. Well, they'd never heard of such a thing. For the first time, I think, in my life, I had to make a choice between following Jesus Christ to the end or going my own way. It really was a decision, not of being born again, but of giving Jesus my whole life. It was very hard for me because I had dreams and I wanted to do something in the world and I wanted to make an impact. And what if I followed Jesus? What if he never gave me a husband? What if I never had children? What if I never had the things I wanted? What if I was always unhappy? And so when I got the call from Cornell, as I began to pray, I felt like the Lord said, he impressed on me, that was not his will for me. It sounded so clamorous. Again, it was a chance to be somebody. I mean, I could be at the university. I could be an administrator. I could be the youngest one to ever have that job. But yes, Lord, yes to whatever you ask of me. And as a junior in college, I can remember after much struggle kneeling by a little couch and opening my hand, not hanging on to my life like this, but opening my hand and putting into my hand all the things I really loved. My family, good health, ambition, dreams for a husband and a home, and I put them all right there. I never hung on to it, and from that day to this, I've kept it open. Yes, Jesus, you can take anything out or put anything in that you see I need. But yes, Lord, I want to be your woman more than I want anything else in the world. So rather than going to Cornell, I went to teach school. I wanted to be somebody as a teacher, too. Again, I mean, I wanted to make an impact on the world, but I was very shy. I was socially very inadequate. I went to this big school outside Kansas City. I taught accelerated students, and my principal was very pseudo-anti-religious and sophisticated. And I was out in the world for the first time trying to make a mark on the world. But I would go to church, and the minister would say, we've got to win the world. I didn't see him doing it, and I didn't know how you're supposed to win the world. I'd always talked about saving souls, but how do you do it? I can remember pushing my chair back from behind my desk one day between classes and walking out into the hall, and I didn't know how to share Jesus at that time. I only knew how to invite someone to my church, and I began to grab students. If you go to church with me Sunday, I'll take you to McDonald's and buy you a free hamburger and Coke. That's when McDonald's were 21 cents apiece. That's how old I am. Well, I was a teacher. Well, Guy, Miss Kimmel, all right, I guess I will. The first Sunday, I took 3 students. The next Sunday, I squeezed 7 into my little Carmen Ghia. And I went up to the senior minister and I said, will you give me a bus? A bus? Well, you said we're supposed to win the world, and how can I win my school when all I have is a Carmen Ghia? If you'll send a bus to my school, I'll fill it. Well, he thought that was a little extravagant. He didn't want me to get too carried away with these dreams. They couldn't send a bus to everybody's school, but they do it one Sunday. I filled it. And because it was such a success, he began letting me take the bus every Sunday, and I would fill it with 20 or 30 students, and I would walk in with 20 or 30 teenagers behind me into this big, sophisticated church. Inevitably, some little lady would come up and say, honey, does your principal know about this? Well, I haven't told him yet, but... And I would walk away terrified. I was going to be persecuted for righteousness' sake. I knew I'd lose my job. So one day I decided I had to go in and tell the principal. I walked in and I thought I would tell it all in one breath. So before he fired me, I could at least tell him my dream. Mr. Wallace, you know, I was always a good student. But it took more than good facts in my brain to make me somebody and happy in life. And I said, I know you may not believe this. I appreciate you letting me have good, strong students. But it's going to take more than that to make them happy. So you don't know, but I've been filling the bus every Sunday, and I've been taking them to my church, and I want them to know Jesus. He leaned back in his chair, and he kind of grinned. I know. you know? He said, parents have been calling in every week. He said, they think it's fantastic. They never heard of a teacher who could live with kids 5 days a week and still want them a sixth. But if you can stand it, you can go on doing it. The people like it. Again, I knew, yes, Lord, it paid. Yes, Lord, to being a teacher for a while. That was God's will for me. That was the beginning point of my learning to share Jesus. That turned the tide in my life from just being a nominal Christian to standing up and saying it takes more than having good morals or even knowing Jesus in my heart, but just standing up and being a good teacher. It means taking Jesus in personal, definite ways to my world. After I taught, well, when I went to teach school, I was very poor, and I went to graduate school at night. I rented this little room on the second floor of this house. It had one sagging bed, no dresser drawers, no lamp. I mean, one little lamp, but no dresser drawers, no heat, and I hated it. I mean, in Kansas City, no heat. I woke up with frost on my eyelashes, and you think I'm exaggerating, but it's true. I hated it. And finally I said, I can't stand it any longer. I began to look in the one ads. I found an ad for a beautiful home right in the neighborhood where I taught school, a widow wanting to rent a room. Oh, it sounded just like what I wanted. I drove over to this beautiful big home, this very sweet lady. Yes, she was looking for someone just like me. She showed me the room. It was heated. The bed was solid and firm. There was a dresser drawers where I would have drawers for my clothes. She said, you know, Ann, I'm kind of lonely too. I would just love to cook your dinner once in a while if you'd like. That'd be great. Well, I moved in. I felt like the Lord had turned the tide in my life. And, you know, the first night I was eating dinner and I heard a noise underneath the kitchen floor. And she kind of tapped me and said, oh, honey, don't worry about that. That's my divorced husband. I bored him in the basement. Divorced husband in the basement? Why, that was the strangest thing I'd ever heard. I thought she was a widow. And then she proceeded to tell me in the next breath, you know, honey, I didn't ask your permission, but I have a fine nephew. Why, he's 6'6". You'll just be so impressed when you meet him. And I've decided to rent the bedroom next to you to him, and the two of you can share the same bath. I knew you wouldn't mind. Well, I staggered off to my bedroom. Why, this was the craziest place I'd ever heard of. Why, Jesus, I hate this. I can't stay here. And I can remember that night calling my father and mother, Daddy, you kept telling me it pays to serve Jesus, and I've tried to be true, but I gave up Cornell to be a teacher, and look at what it's brought me. I've been taking students to church. I've been following Jesus, but I've been living in that awful little room, and now I found this room. But look at it. Why does it pay it? Nothing goes right. Daddy, Mother, I want to come home. The world is too hard. I can't make it. My father said, honey, you know, we don't really have money to bring you home, first of all. But I suppose we could go out and borrow it. But, Ann, we've taught you children to face your mountains. And if Jesus isn't big enough to help you right there in that situation, then Jesus isn't what we taught you he was all your lives. And we just have faith in God, and we want you to stay there and stick it out. I hung up and thought, that's true. I can never change the world. I can never make a difference if I give up on all these mountains. And I can remember the next day was Sunday, and I walked into my church. I didn't bring my students. I was too discouraged to talk to anybody. I could hardly get to church. I asked the usher to seat me down at the end of a pew away from everybody. And I sat down, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I couldn't live in that house. They were weird. And where I couldn't go back to that little cold, unheated room. And suddenly I heard someone say, Ann. And I looked down, and here was this couple, retired couple that I had known for a long time. They said, move down here, sit close to us. The first thing the wife said was, Ann, where are you living now? Well, I'm living with a lady in a house. And her husband leaned over and said, "You know, for several weeks my wife and I have been talking. We have this big, beautiful home. We have a guest room with a king-size bed and a private bath. And we're just kind of lonely. We need your kind of youth and enthusiasm. And we were kind of talking about where you lived because we'd like you to live with us. We'd like to fix you popcorn and ice cream when you come in from school. And we'd like you to live there for free just because we just love you." The hymn of the morning, the first hymn of the morning, was "Be Not Dismayed, Whate'er Betide, God Will Take Care of You." Nobody understood why I was crying, but Jesus did, and I did. And again I knew, as a first-year teacher out in the big, hard world, it pays. Yes, Lord. Yes, Lord, to wherever you lead me. Yes, Lord, some way, somehow, in the long haul of life, you make a difference. So I taught school for 2 years and loved it so much, and out of the clear blue, got a call to be a youth director. Well, I'd never even considered full-time Christian service. And they had heard about me bringing students to the church, and I guess that's why I got called. And I came to Long Beach, California, and I started with that little handful of students. I can remember when I walked into that big youth room at the church, there were just a few kids there, and they were throwing spitwads. I got up and told them I made one demand. I did not demand that they be Christians. That was personal. No one could demand that of someone else. I did not demand that they be committed people. That was personal too, but I demanded that they have the dignity to respect my God when they came to that youth room. Now, I had always heard that when you work in the church, you can't make the same kinds of demands on students or kids that you make at school. But how could I allow kids to throw spit wads and chomp on gum and swing on their chairs in Sunday school? I wasn't going to allow it. The first Sunday night, here I was, shy and new. I'd never had any Christian education training. I came to this job without ever expecting to do Christian work. And the first Sunday night in the big sanctuary, there were 800 or 900 people, and the senior minister was getting ready to speak. And Jimmy, he was 3 rows back. His father was the head board member's son. Everybody said I should give up on Jimmy. He was hopeless. But about midway through the service, I wrote a little note back to Jimmy and said, "Jimmy, you shape up or I'll see you out." And as the senior minister walked to the podium, Jimmy hadn't shaped up. So I got up. He waited, 800 eyes on me. I walked 3 rows back and said, "Jimmy, out." "No way. Are you? You heard me, baby. Out." You say, "Ann, what would you have done if he hadn't gotten up?" "I don't know. He was bigger than I was. But I looked fierce. And I just stood there." And he kind of got up nonchalantly. And I watched him walk out to the back pew. And the usher seated him on the last row. And I turned around and went back and sat down. And the senior minister proceeded to deliver his evening message. You say, "Ann, how did you feel?" "Sick." I wanted to quit. I wanted to run back to Kansas City the very next morning. You say, "How did the teens feel?" "They hated me." It wasn't that they liked what Jimmy did, but Jimmy was an old-timer. I was the new youth director. What kind of business did I have making a request like that? But after the service, I didn't run up to Jimmy and say, "Oh, Jimmy, I'm so sorry. You know, I made a threat and I have to follow through on it, but you know, I didn't mean to offend you." I didn't. I walked out of that service, and I knew the head board member, the father of Jimmy, was probably ready to send me back to Kansas City. And the teenagers hated me, but I went back to my little apartment, and I pulled out a piece of paper. "Dear Jimmy, I'm not writing to say I'm sorry. I'm writing to say I'll do it again if I have to. But I'm writing to tell you I love you. And the reason why I'm hard on you is that I see potential in your life, and I'm not about to let it go by underboard. I am going, by the help of God, to make a man out of you. Love, Ann." And I got in my little car, and I went over to Jimmy's house, and with tears running down my face, pressed the doorbell and handed him the letter, said nothing, and went back to my car. Sometime between that moment and the next few months, I balanced my demand for respect with love. Jimmy knew if he ever cut up again, I'd send him out. But Jimmy also knew that I loved him because I'd go watch him surf. I'd watch him ride the waves at Huntington Pier. I'd cheer him when he'd make a wave, and I'd even cheer him when he spilled. I'd take him ice cream or Pepsis, and we'd sit on his front steps, and he'd tell me his girl problems. And I really loved him, and I cared about him, and I wrote him little notes when he had hard times at school. And I gave my best to being a youth director. I really did. I wrote 100 personal notes to my teenagers a week. I had a breakfast at 6 o'clock one morning a week so that kids from all over Southern California could come. And my group grew from 88 to hundreds because I told them that even though we were a small, everyday group of teenagers, if we could learn to love each other and believe in the greatness of God, we could do anything. Well, my youth group was going so well, and I loved it. And suddenly I got the call to be Dean of Women at Eastern Nazarene College in Boston. Dean of Women? Whoever wanted to be a dean? I mean, every dean I'd ever met was radical, conservative, hair pulled back tight, piled on her head, 70 years old, maybe a returned missionary who had lots of rules. I didn't want to be a dean. I was 23 years old, almost 24. Besides, my youth group and I, we were going to move the world. We were in California. We were inspiring people. Our group was growing. Yes, Lord. Yes to anything you ask of me, anytime, anywhere. Yes, Lord, to moving to Boston, to the other side of the country, to nobody I knew. In the middle of January, from warm weather to freezing cold. Yes, Lord, to even being Dean of Women on a college campus. I was the youngest Dean of Women in America when I went. I blew onto that campus thinking everybody would love me, and hardly anybody liked me. Why, they thought I was a child. My colleagues questioned anything I did. The lady who was the former dean, well, she was wonderful, but she fed the girls cookies and prayed with them. That wasn't all my style. I liked to feed them cookies and pray with them, but I did more than that. And she took over the bookstore. And every time I'd go into the college bookstore to buy something, she would take me to the back room, put her hand on my head, "Oh, dear Lord, bless this young girl and this job." I resented it. I was going to do it. Jesus and I, we could be a good dean. We could do this job. The first year and a half, I lived with more criticism than I ever have before or since. You know, I went to Eastern Nazarene as a girl, and I left as a woman. Because before that time, when people criticized me, I'd say, "Boy, does he have a problem. She said that, did she? Well, she needs to go home and pray a little harder." I never realized that there was some truth to criticism for me. And I began to listen to criticism, and I began to grow from it, and I began to mature. And after the first year and a half, I think I became a pretty good dean. I feel like the Lord really helped me, and the Lord strengthened me. And I loved being a dean of women. I was a dean of women for 5 years. I listened to all kinds of problems. I dealt with every problem that I think exists in the world among college students. I tried to do my best. And then, out of the clear blue, they asked me to write a book. I would fly out of town on Friday to speak on Saturday and fly home on Sunday to be dean on Monday. Well, in the process, several publishers said, "Ann, will you write a book?" Well, I didn't think anyone would read it, but yes, I would. And my first little book, my main little book, was I'm Out to Change My World. And when it came time for the booksellers convention, they said, "Now, Ann, you know, nobody's ever heard of you, so we've got to stand you next to an important author. Otherwise, no one will want your autograph." I flew into Minneapolis, and they had decided to stand me next to Gloria Gaither. She was somebody. And she was all dressed up, and she looked so beautiful, and I had this little smock dress on, and the hundreds of people lined up. They didn't even look at me, but they had to get by me to get to Gloria. So they'd kind of stick out, "I'm out to change my world," but they just looked at Gloria. They didn't even look at me, and signed my book and went on to Gloria. That night I went to my hotel room and thought, I wonder what Ann Kimmel writes about. It was the first day of my life I was a published author. I was going to try to be objective about my work. I picked up my little book and began to read. I tell you the truth, I cried. Jesus, this is the worst book I ever read. Why, Jesus, this is going to embarrass us. I just prayed he would help the book to die a quiet death. For a whole year, I never told anybody I wrote that book. I didn't keep a copy of it. I tried to pretend it didn't even exist, and I just prayed it would kind of be washed under and no one would ever know. Then no one would feel sorry for me, and no one would be embarrassed. But that night in that hotel room, Jesus seemed to say to me, Anne, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. Anne, I have not called you to be an author. I have not called you to be a great speaker. I have called you to be a real Christian in my name where you live. And I flew out of Minneapolis back to Boston to try to be God's woman back where I had started. Yes, Lord, to your will for my life. Well, the publishers called in a year. They couldn't believe it. My book had become a bestseller. Why, they hadn't even publicized it. I couldn't believe it either. We were all shocked. I'm sure it happened because people like you read it and bought 30 copies and passed it out. I know you've told me stories like that. It means more to me than you know. Even to this day, I can't read that book. But I appreciate it that you do. And after I wrote that book, they asked me to write another one. And you know, I've written a couple more since then. And my new book has already gone to press and will be out in September. And as my life became more and more public, and I began speaking to bigger crowds, not because I asked to, it just seemed to happen. I couldn't do everything. I couldn't be a dean and love my neighborhood and fly every week and write books. I was just one young woman. And I decided no one could write my dreams and no one could speak them and no one else could live in my neighborhood, but somebody else could be a dean. People say, Anne, you gave up being a dean of women on a college campus to live in your neighborhood? I did, because it takes a lot of time to love your neighborhood, you know. I mean, I get up every morning to meet my mailman. I sing him a little song. I thank him for being my mailman. I have tea with the maintenance men, lunch with businessmen. I have a Bible study for women. I take children to the park. I have to work very hard because I'm only home a few days a week and I have to love my whole neighborhood to Jesus those days. So I resigned from the college. Again, it was a hard thing. By that time, I loved that job. It was the favorite thing I'd ever done. I felt secure in it. It was steady income. It brought many rewards. But yes, Lord, I will resign from being dean of women to just speaking and writing and living in my neighborhood. I will go out by faith. Jesus, I don't know if you can use me. I'm one simple life, but here I am. And the next crisis in my life really came when I became such a public person. It was hard for me. Suddenly, people from all over the country were writing me letters. They were telling me how to wear my hair. They were telling me how to do things, different stories I should tell, how to speak. They were criticizing me because I couldn't come to their little town, and they knew it was true, what they had feared all along. I just didn't practice what I preached. I wasn't really genuine. And I began getting criticism, and I couldn't board a plane without knowing that somebody might recognize me and be watching me to see if I would do all the right things I'm supposed to do, like sing to the man next to me. And I became very shy. And I became inhibited about being a public person. And last summer was a real crisis for me. I was to address the National Booksellers Convention, and this time, 3 years later, I was no longer an unknown, but I was, quote, somebody in their eyes, unquote. And they wanted me to address this national convention, and then I was to go on to two more conventions. Well, I can remember calling my manager, Wayne Coombs, at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, Wayne, I can't go on. I can't be a dreamer. I'm just not cut out for this. I can't be tough in the world. I can't handle all the criticism. Why, people don't even know me, and they say things, and they make judgments about me, and it's harder than I thought to change the world, and I'm not strong enough. And, Wayne said, who do you think is bigger, you, God, or the people around you? Well, I know God is. But Wayne, God will choose somebody else. He'll lay his hand on another young life. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, weeping in my little apartment, saying, I can't. And Wayne saying, Ann, let me pray with you. And when we finished praying, I hung up the phone and I knelt in my little apartment. And again, I opened my hand. Jesus, I give all of this to you. Jesus, I just started out to dream for my neighborhood. I didn't ask you to make me a messenger to the world. I just wanted to love my neighbors. But Jesus, here it is. Here's my future. Here's my loneliness. Here are all the pressures. Here are the criticisms. And I gave him everything. I gave him my books. I gave him my dreams. And I told him to take me again, and I would try to make Yes, Lord, the continuing motto of my life. I got up the next morning to fly to the convention. I really felt hopeless. I really felt that there was no joy or song in my life, and I couldn't go on. It was too awesome and too big, and I didn't want it. And after I finished speaking that day, Jim Dobson, Dr. James Dobson, whom some of you may be familiar with, he addressed the convention with me. And afterwards he said, Ann, come to Shirley in my room. Let's visit. And I went to their hotel room, and he said, Ann, every time I hear you speak, I feel touched by your message. I know the Lord can make your dreams live. Jim, thank you, but I'm quitting. I can't go on. I mean, I've had a long talk with Wayne, and I just feel like I'm not God's woman for the world. I mean, I'm the woman for my neighborhood, but I can't stand being such a public person. And Jim Dobson was raised a Nazarene like I was, and he had an old-fashioned father like I do, and he flew off the bed on his knees. Well, I hardly ever see people get on their knees to pray. He flew off the bed, Shirley got on her knees beside him, and I got on my knees, and he began to cry and pray like nobody I'd heard in a long time. Jesus, give Ann courage. Give Ann courage to be true to you, whatever it means. Give Ann courage to stand tall. Help her to be brave when she's so lonely and the world seems so big. Help her to be brave if it means not having a home or a normal life. Jesus, he said, I pray that you will give Ann your sense of power so that nothing, not criticism, not pressure, will take your love out of her life. And ladies and gentlemen, I tell you today that I walked out of Jim and Shirley's hotel room back to my little room, and Jesus seemed to say to me, Ann, all the battles are won. All the battles up ahead, they're won. You're going to make it. And it was different. I didn't care who criticized me. I didn't care how anyone wanted me to wear my hair. I didn't care what kind of letters came in. I didn't care how big the world was. Yes, Lord. Yes to whatever it is you ask of me from now on, you and I, Jesus, together, we can do it. Yes, Lord, takes courage. But when I talk about the committed life, I guess if I have one question, it is, where are all the committed people who are willing to say, yes, Lord, yes, I'll be a mother instead of a career woman. Or, yes, Lord, I'll really love my husband if you will give me power to do that. Or, yes, Lord, I'm just a little girl. I know there are a lot of little girls here today. Yes, Lord, I'm just a little girl. And my school's so big, and I'm afraid the kids will laugh. But, yes, Lord, if you'll live in me, I'll try to stand tall. And I'll believe that even though I'm one little girl, you can make a difference. I flew to Seattle to address this convention, and this young couple met me. They had a little tiny daughter, and her legs were in braces, and we took turns carrying her through the airport. This young couple said, Ann, the reason why we came to pick you up is that we heard you speak when we were still in college, and we're dreamers too. So when we got to the car, this little Paula wanted to sit on my lap, and I picked her up and put her on my lap, and she said, Ann, guess what? What? I'm going to get a baby brother. Are you? But her mother didn't look like she was ready to produce a baby, and I didn't know. I said, well, where is the baby going to be? And the mother in the front seat turned around and said, "Ann, Paula doesn't understand. I gave birth to a baby boy 3 weeks ago. He was perfect. He was just what we wanted. But last night the doctor called and said our baby was dying. He developed a respiratory problem. And the doctor called and said, 'Can I take your baby off the respirator? He's only going to live a few more minutes. You can't make it to the hospital, and I love your baby.'" And Julie, the young mother, said, "We told him he could." And she said he called back a little later and said our baby was gone. And she said, "Ann, the doctor said our baby was the bravest baby he had known, and he wondered if he could go to the funeral." And she looked at me from the front seat. "Ann, do you think we could love that doctor to Jesus?" "Yes, Julie." She went on to tell me that the reason little Paula had braces on her legs was because she had cerebral palsy, and Paula is never to walk again. But Julie said, "Of course, that's one of our dreams, too. We believe for Paula." I was overwhelmed. There they were with all their sorrow and pain, and they had come to pick me up because they were dreamers, too. They came to hear me speak that night and the next morning, and I went that afternoon to the funeral. I saw the doctor sitting next to that young couple. After the funeral, I went up to Mike and Julie before I had to head to the airport. "Mike, Julie, tell me, how do you really feel?" And Mike began to cry. He said, "Ann, I don't know if you can understand this. We're just a simple couple. But more than ever, we feel like we're ready to change the world. If we hadn't lost our little son, maybe we wouldn't know how to hurt with people when they hurt and feel sorrow when they feel sorrow. And if Paula weren't crippled, maybe we wouldn't know how to believe in other people's impossible dreams, too. And we live in this little simple house on an ordinary plain street, and we're just one couple. But when the world seems big and you feel small, Anne, remember there's a couple named Mike and Julie, and we love you, and we're committed to Jesus with you, and we're going to make a difference." I walked away from that couple knowing more than ever before that to really love, to make "Yes, Lord," the motto of your life or mine, is to be vulnerable. It's to allow Jesus to take out or put in whatever he wants. For Mike and Julie, it was taking away that little baby son. But I just got word a few weeks ago that Mike and Julie have a brand new baby. I don't know. That baby's going to grow up to be special in the world. And Mike and Julie, the great thing about them is this. They didn't get angry and bitter at God. Oh, I'm sure at first they did. That's human. But they didn't let it gnaw at them. They didn't raise their fist and say, "God, we wanted to change the world and we wanted to love you, but why did you do this to us? Why did you take our baby?" They kept their lives open. They let God do what he knew he needed to do for them. And he refined them and melted them and molded them and shaped them and made them sensitive. And they are braver and stronger and more ready for the world. And now they have a new baby. Jesus has put something beautiful back in. That's what it takes. What things I once thought were gain, I now count as loss. I count everything as loss, but one thing, really knowing Jesus and taking him to my world. Letting Jesus be Lord in me. Not 50%, not 75%, but 100%. Jesus, take me and make me yours in the world so that you and I together, even as you did with the disciples, we can stand tall and see the sunrise. Though I walk through darkest valley, I've been there lots of times. Though the sky be cold and gray, I've had lots of those too. But the sunshine always comes back. Though I climb the steepest mountain, God, do I have to climb another mountain? And don't you know that dreams are made of mountains? So like a lamb who needs a shepherd, by his side I'll always stay. And Jesus and I, in love, will climb our mountains together and see the peaks. You watch. You wait. Believe with me. I need you to.
We hope you enjoyed this testimony by Ann Kimmel. If so, you'll also benefit from her studies on being a Christian in today's world, available in an 8-cassette resource with study guide titled, Love is Something You Are, 10 Sessions on Christian Discipleship. For more information, see your local Christian bookstore or write to Word Incorporated, Waco, Texas, 76796.